So you have, at this part of the story, you have several things that are important. You have Swamiji's, from the point of view of Swami, really trying to explain what happened with SRF. You have him trying to set the record straight on his communication with Dayamata, which is simply, SRF has tried to have other thoughts be true, that he acted without authorization and so on. But he didn't. He was in communication with her. But then the rest of this whole chapter is all about, you know, the involvement he got into with this woman in SRF. And Swamiji also just talking. And, you know, it's so interesting because it's a very delicate subject to talk about. To talk about sexual temptation, falling into that trap. How does a person feel about that? How do you deal with that? And right now, at this moment, you know, in Ananda's history, it's not a big story, but of course this was such a huge thing that happened from 1994 to, you know, until 1998 when that sexual harassment lawsuit was filed and women accused Swamiji of sexual activity when he was supposed to be celibate. And this huge, terrible brouhaha got started that just got so insanely out of proportion. And it isn't happening right now, but it is a quality of America to become very obsessive about these things. And it's an important aspect of life to understand because it plays such a big role in everybody's life. And whether you're trying to be celibate or just trying to be faithful to whatever vows you may have taken, marriage vows or whatever vows you may have taken or whatever life you've put in front of you, Swamiji talks here about something that is really a very serious reality and talks a little bit about how Master dealt with him about it and how he's worked with himself. And it's important things to understand. It's also important to understand because people have such an unrealistic expectation about what it means to take a vow of celibacy. As Swami himself says, when I took that vow, it wasn't a declaration that this was who I was. It was a declaration merely that this is who I would try to become. And then he also just tells us this sort of small point that just slides in here, which is that Master told him not to speak to anyone about it, not anyone, not Rajasi, Dr. Lewis, not anyone. This came out in a most interesting manner, in a very dramatic scene that took place in the middle of the Bertolucci lawsuit when various women had accused Swamiji. You know, the facts of just to set the record straight. In 1981, Swamiji publicly announced that he was no longer going to be a celibate monk. And from 1981 until 1995, he wasn't living that lifestyle. He was still called Swami because the word means teacher. But it was clear to everyone he was married. He had open relationships. And during the time that he was accused of having relationships with women was a time when he had declared he wasn't going to be a celibate anymore. I sort of said to people later, what do you think that meant? You know, like, think about it. What do you think it meant? But in any case, when the accusations were leveled at Swamiji, Swami was absolutely silent about it. He just refused to say anything. And people were demanding explanations and revelations. He had many reasons for not answering, one of which was, quite simply, I don't owe you an explanation. You know, I've never asked you to justify your life to me, and I don't see any reason why I have to justify my life to you. I've never asked anything of you. And you, when you stopped and thought about it, you realized he never had. He said, I've just lived my life and been helpful as I could. And he never had. He never. By contrast, I want to say a few things about that. Like there was another ashram that, a lot of ashrams were coming to pieces over sexual revelations at that period of time. The Swami said Satan was trying to mow down the yoga movement. In fact, Swami himself said that he prayed to Divine Mother. He said, somebody has to stand up to it. He said, I will stand up to it. And he did. He really took the heat. And it was interesting because in our ashram, it was not an internal dispute. In some of the other ashrams, they broke apart from the inside. But ours was an external attack because we were strong in our loyalty to Swami. But Swamiji, when these revelations came out, when these women made accusations to him, which were very, I mean, they were presented extremely luridly, but the actual facts, when Swami later testified, were so minor, and they were not abusive. You know, it was the story, as Swamiji said, of a man who wasn't always perfect. You know, but it wasn't an abuse of position or power as it was presented, which is completely different. But Swami never said a word. He just wouldn't say anything in his defense. He wouldn't speak about it, he just wouldn't relate to it. And finally, Flynn, the attorney for Bertolucci, got Swamiji into depositions and got him backed into a corner and demanded that he answer direct questions. And Swami refused to answer. And there was a judge sitting in on the depositions as a referee because Flynn had been so abusive we had to have a judge there. And it was like there was the question of whether the judge was going to declare Swamiji in contempt because he was refusing to answer these questions. And our lawyer called a recess. And we went out to a restaurant nearby. And Swami says, he told us, he said, Master told me never to speak about this. He said, it's been very difficult for me. It's not my nature to be secretive. He said, I've always been too open, just like he writes here. He said, but Master told me never to speak of it. He said, so? He said, if it were just me alone, he said, I wouldn't speak of it now. He said, but if I hold to what Master said, it will hurt Ananda. He said, so I feel on the horns of a dilemma. And then he turned to Sheila, myself, Jyotish, Dr. Peter, John Parsons. He said, what should I do? Like that. Later on, Swamiji said, he already knew what he was going to do. He wasn't really giving the decision over to us, but he was testing the decision. And then Swami just went silent again. He just sat there. You know, we sort of all just like looked at each other like, well, what should you do? But our consensus was the same as his, which is that whatever purpose Master had in mind had been served, and it didn't, the only reason to steadfastly obey such a thing and go to prison for it is to prove something to yourself, really. And at that point, it didn't seem necessary, and that was the conclusion Swamiji had come to. So he went back in and he answered, you know, simple questions. And you can read it all on the internet, so the questions are very simple, and the answers were very simple. And that was the story. But it was when Swami then afterwards wrote this, and now that he felt that he could speak about these things, because he somehow felt inwardly that whatever Master's prohibition to him. But isn't it just interesting how everything gets set up that way? Because but what it also has done is it's created with Swami as an example a real challenge to a lot of really immature attitudes that people carry. Swamiji, in the midst of the Bertolucci lawsuit, wrote a paper called Guru's Celibacy and Spiritual Authority. And it was a very, very good paper. And he just basically wrote, you know, who are you to judge these people? And who are you to decide that this is the criteria of whether or not someone has anything to teach you? And how can you be so arrogant as to think that you can't learn, you know, that you set up all these conditions and only then are you willing to learn? He said, almost no one has the good karma to be with the really self-realized master. What all the rest of you kids are going to get is going to get people who are a little more advanced than you. And they can help you a lot if you'll let them help you, but they won't help you at all if you stand around and judge them for the process of finishing their own karma. Now, the other thing that I've always found interesting about this, that I found interesting from the very beginning, is the fact that, and Swamiji chronicles here things exactly. He talks about, you know, him expressing to Master concern about this, expressing an overzealous concern, I'd rather commit suicide than give in to temptation. And Master says, why speak of suicide? And when Swami reads it, he says, you know, come on, don't be so dramatic, is kind of what Master says. He said, this isn't deep in you, you'll overcome it. And then Swami just states, just categorically, and I have. Now, you have to stop and realize what Swami means when he speaks of overcoming this. He doesn't mean merely that he has control over his impulses. He means he has no inclination to think in terms of male or female anymore. He has no attraction to what is the most fundamental delusion. Swami's not a braggart. He doesn't make statements like that without knowing what he means. Even in the midst of the whole Bertolucci thing, when there was a big cycle within the community, while Swami said everybody worked it out, Swami just went to Hawaii. He said, I just don't have the patience for it. You just figure it out. He said, I've been your friend for all these years and you just make up your own minds. And then he came back at one point and he was in seclusion writing a book, and then just at the end he gave a satsang. And he basically said, no one who was a libertine could accomplish what I've accomplished. He just said, it's just not possible. And he just sort of left it like that again, just left it to sort of see, you know, where we would go with this.
No one who is a libertine.
No one is a libertine. No one who didn't have mastery over their energy could accomplish what I've accomplished. So I always looked at it the other way around. Swamiji had said it on the different occasions that when he asked Master the question, will I find God in this lifetime? Master said, yes. Everything is balanced. Now that is, will I be self-realized in this lifetime? That's the question that Swami asked him. And Master said, yes. You know, Swami just puts that. This is one of these things, just puts it out as a sentence. Now, if you believe that Swami is truthful, which certainly that's the premise of my discussion, if you believe that Master is truthful and would be able to answer that question honestly, then you work backwards. Then you realize that you're looking at a person who's having their last incarnation. And then you think, my, isn't it interesting how these things play themselves out? This is a little bit of the long discussion we had last week, where at a certain point you have to actually just look at what's happening instead of rebelling all the time about what's happening and throwing up continuously these questions of how can that be, how can that be, how can a direct disciple like Daya be like this, how can Taramata be like that? You have to just stop doing that. And you have to work backwards. And you have to say, wow, look what great souls are capable of doing. You know, look at the kind of karma that a person can face in their last lifetime. Look what it looks like to overcome this. Because Swami says, Master said, you have it, you're going to overcome it. Okay, Swami says, I had it, I've overcome it. So you look at sort of the cycle of you know, being dragged into court and humiliated by these awful women and, you know, forced to describe in detail things that nobody should ever talk about. It's just crazy. But there it is. And then you have to reorient your own life around that fact. You have to see Swamiji at the height of this spiritual bhav. And he's being modest when he's talking to us about how he felt when he was in India, that he was so free. And he had that extraordinary relationship with Anandamayi Ma, and she said such things about him that she's never said about anyone. No one has come before this body and received in the way that you have received. You know, and I've never been attracted to anyone like I've been attracted to you. Swami just states those things. Those are remarkable statements. And then Swami just talks about this extraordinary freedom, and he's lecturing to thousands of people in India, and he's just drifting through with this marvelous thing. And then he goes back to America, and he falls into the clutches of this woman who's in love with him. And so you have to see, wow, the path is really a drama. It's really an up and down cycle, and no one is safe until you're in Nirvikalpa Samadhi. And then he reminds us that Ma had warned him, had encouraged him to try to lift the energy a little higher, but he didn't know how, and he was so enjoying this. You know, she could sort of see the little bit of a karmic cloud in there that was going to pull him down. But even then, Swamiji talks about it, how it was her... The look of desire and the longing in her, that he couldn't hurt her. You know, of course he could have hurt her, but he didn't. And again, you have to realize these are all great souls, and this is the adventure of their lives. Swami's being very frank. You don't know what else has gone on that we haven't heard about, but you can assume that you have. So when your own life takes a pattern that you don't expect, or your brothers and sisters, you have to see it in context for what it really is. And also recognize nothing is forever. Taramata herself left against Master's wishes and got married and then came back. When they speak in there of the nun who criticized the one for leaving and getting married, it was Taramata. Tara got married. Master suggested she not do it, but she did. And she had a child. She came back with a child to SRF. And among the reasons why she lived elsewhere is because she was raising a daughter, right? Yeah, and then nobody talks about that. It's such a shame that they don't talk about it, because then you don't get a real picture of the spiritual path. It does irreparable damage to devotees not to know these facts. It's a fine line. It's a dilemma that I actually face within the context of Ananda, because Well, let's just say a lot of us have been on the path for a long time, and some of us have more colorful history than you may be aware of. And I never know whether to speak of all of it or just let it go, because it's the past. For the same reasons, it's a delicate point. You don't want to affirm it if it's behind you, but you don't want people to think that they're any different than anybody else for what they go through. I had one more thought with that. Oh, it was Taramata when she came back. Someone said to her, "You know, how dare you come back after disobeying Master like that?" And Tara, in her acerbic way, said, "Do you want me to just worship my mistakes?" It was a perfect answer. You know, I made a mistake, so what? I'm not going to enshrine it for the rest of my life. And that's how Swami, you know, works with this. So I made a mistake. And then he says later, he said, "I just realized I couldn't fight all battles at the same time." So I just, and that's also an extremely important point. You know, he writes about that more, I think, in part two, just about how he just couldn't, because he was so unprotected as a monk. And none of you, I mean, some of you, I know, have lived as renunciates, as formally, specifically, not merely by circumstance, but by choice. It's no easy matter in this culture. And it's no easy matter, as Swami writes in that paper, because the women don't respect it. They don't understand it. He said in India, at least, they understand. They keep their distance. But he writes here, too, about the woman in the church, you know, teasing them, just not having any concept of what's involved. And it's no small issue. Okay, any other comments or questions? And then Swamiji, of course, while he was there, and then he just has this terrible story of how he needed an assistant, and Taramata assigned him this completely uncongenial companion. You know, you can see why Swamiji has been so... He says at the end of this section, too, all of his experiences in SRF taught him so much about how to make Ananda. And you can just see that just the sheer helplessness of having a partner assigned to you astrologically when you don't have any affinity for them. And once again, Swami just saying, well, if that's how they want to do it, that's how they want to do it. You know, there's a quality that comes out through all this, which is not a pretense. It is the way Swami is. As much willpower and energy as he has, he also, when it's not appropriate, he just doesn't resist. And many, many times when there are circumstances when a lesser mortal would fight against it, he instead doesn't. He just, if that's how people are going to do it, he's just going to let them do it. He's not going to fight every battle and try to make everything. He doesn't try to control events. When he sees the hand of God, he just sees the hand of God. It's probably a very strong intuitive sense of when to stand up and when not to, but also a very strong recognition of when other people will be receptive to his attempts to change reality. Because since I'm speaking of the Bertolucci one, I wrote this on the website. There was an amazing part of the Bertolucci experience, which was that, you know, we had a terrible lawyer. And Swamiji immediately told us he was the wrong lawyer for us. But somehow the energy was just going toward that man. And the people that Swami was saying that to could not hear it. And Swami knew this man was going to be a disaster for us, and he was such a disaster for us. And Swami just knew it, and he just said, well, there you have it. You know, it was such an extraordinary example of the opposite of what he was being accused of. He was being accused of being such a, you know, a power-grabbing dictator. And in a matter that concerned him so deeply and so personally, he allowed other people to make the wrong decision rather than interfere with their right to make that decision. Remarkable, isn't it? And it's, you know, it's a very subtle quality you don't see because you think of him so much as a person of willpower. But that's a lot of what Ananda is based on, is the kind of example and lessons that Swami has shown of just, if people aren't receptive to what you have to say, then you just stand back and let them play it out. Because if you fight too hard, you do so much violence to your relationships and to other people's free will. And remarkable courage, isn't it? So just exactly the opposite of how can we send the tape out unless you first give it to us and let us review it. All right. Why don't we just take a... It's a little early, but let's take a short break.